Chapter 53, The Judges, Deliverers of Israel. Satisfied with the territory already gained, the tribe's zeal flagged, and the war was discontinued. When Israel was strong, they put the Canaanites to tribute, and did not utterly drive them out. The Lord had faithfully fulfilled, on his part, the promises made to Israel. It only remained for them to complete the work of dispossessing the inhabitants of the land. But this they failed to do. By entering into league with the Canaanites, they transgressed the command of God and failed to fulfill the condition on which he had promised to place them in possession of Canaan. At Sinai they had been warned against idolatry. "Thou shalt not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do after their works, but thou shalt utterly overthrow them, and quite break down their images." So long as they remained obedient, God would subdue their enemies. "I will send my fear before thee, and will destroy all the people to whom thou shalt come, and I will send hornets before thee, which shall drive out the Hivite, the Canaanite, and the Hittite, from before thee. I will not drive them out from before thee in 1 year, lest the land become desolate, and the beast of the field multiply against thee. By little and little I will drive them out from before thee, until thou be increased, and inherit the land. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in thy land, lest they make thee sin against me, for if thou serve their gods, it will surely be a snare unto thee." God had placed his people in Canaan to stay the tide of moral evil, that it might not flood the world. God would give into their hands nations greater and more powerful than the Canaanites. "Ye shall possess greater nations and mightier than yourselves, from the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even unto the uttermost sea shall your coast be." But they chose ease and self-indulgence. They let slip their opportunities for completing the conquest of the land. And for many generations they were afflicted by the remnant of these idolatrous peoples, that were as pricks in their eyes and thorns in their sides. The Israelites were mingled among the heathen, and learned their works. They intermarried with the Canaanites, and idolatry spread like a plague throughout the land. Yea, they sacrificed their sons and their daughters unto devils, and the land was polluted with blood. Therefore was the wrath of the Lord kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance. Until the generation that had received instruction from Joshua became extinct, idolatry made little headway, but the parents prepared the way for the apostasy of their children. The simple habits of the Hebrews had secured them physical health, but association with the heathen led to indulgence of appetite and passion, which gradually enfeebled the mental and moral powers. By their sins the Israelites were separated from God, and they could no longer prevail against their enemies. Thus they were brought into subjection to the very nations that they might have subdued. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt. They provoked him to anger with their high places, and moved him to jealousy with their graven images. Therefore the Lord forsook the tabernacle of Shiloh, the tent which he placed among them, and delivered his strength into captivity, and his glory into the enemy's hand. Yet he did not utterly forsake his people. There was ever a remnant who were true to Jehovah, and from time to time the Lord raised up faithful and valiant men to put down idolatry and deliver the Israelites from their enemies. But when the deliverer was dead and the people were released from his authority, they would gradually return to their idols. Thus the story of backsliding and chastisement, of confession and deliverance was repeated again and again. The sad story of continual backsliding. The king of Mesopotamia, the king of Moab, and after them the Philistines, and the Canaanites of Hazor led by Sisera, in turn became oppressors of Israel. Othniel, Shamgar, Ehud, Deborah, and Barak were raised up as deliverers of their people. But again the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of Midian. The Midianites had been nearly destroyed by the Israelites in the days of Moses, but they had since become numerous and powerful. They thirsted for revenge, and now that the protecting hand of God was withdrawn from Israel, the opportunity had come. The whole land suffered from their ravages. Like a devouring plague, they spread over the country. They came as soon as the harvests began to ripen, and remained until the last fruits had been gathered. They stripped the fields of their increase, and robbed and maltreated the inhabitants. The Israelites dwelling in the open country were forced to seek refuge in fortresses or even find shelter in caves among the mountains. For 7 years this oppression continued. Then, as the people in their distress confessed their sins, God again raised up a helper for them. To Gideon came the divine call to deliver his people. He was engaged at the time in threshing wheat. Not daring to beat it out on the ordinary threshing floor, he had resorted to a spot near the wine press. The season of ripe grapes being still far off, little notice was now taken of the vineyards. As Gideon labored in secrecy, he sadly pondered the condition of Israel and how the oppressor's yoke might be broken. How the Lord called Gideon. Suddenly the angel of the Lord appeared and addressed him with the words, "Jehovah is with thee, thou mighty man of valor." "O my Lord," was his answer, "if the Lord be with us, why then is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of? The Lord hath forsaken us, and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites." The messenger of heaven replied, "Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent thee?" Gideon desired some token that the one now addressing him was the covenant angel, who in time past had wrought for Israel. Hastening to his tent, he prepared from his scanty store a kid and unleavened cakes which he brought forth and set before him. But the angel bade him, "Take the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock, and pour out the broth." Gideon did so. And then the sign he desired was given. With the staff in his hand, the angel touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and a flame bursting from the rock consumed the sacrifice. Then the angel vanished. Gideon's father, Joash, who shared in the apostasy of his countrymen, had erected at Ophrah a large altar to Baal. Gideon was commanded to destroy this altar and to erect an altar to Jehovah over the rock on which the offering had been consumed, and there present a sacrifice to the Lord. The offering of sacrifice had been committed to the priests and restricted to the altar at Shiloh, but he who had established the ritual service had power to change its requirements. Gideon must declare war on idolatry before going out to battle with the enemies of his people. Gideon performed the work in secret, with the aid of his servants accomplishing the whole in one night. Great was the rage of the men of Ophrah when they came next morning to pay their devotions to Baal. Joash, who had been told of the angel's visit, stood in defense of his son. "Will ye plead for Baal? Will ye save him? He that will plead for him, let him be put to death whilst it is yet morning." If Baal could not defend his own altar, how could he be trusted to protect his worshippers? All thoughts of violence toward Gideon were dismissed. When he sounded the trumpet of war, the men of Ophrah were among the first to gather to his standard. Heralds were dispatched to his own tribe of Manasseh, and also to Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and all answered the call. How could Gideon be sure? Gideon prayed, "If thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool in the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth besides, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said." In the morning the fleece was wet, while the ground was dry. But now a doubt arose, since wool naturally absorbs moisture when there is any in the air. The test might not be decisive. Hence he asked that the sign be reversed. His request was granted. Thus encouraged, Gideon led out his forces to give battle to the invaders. All the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together, and went over, and pitched in the valley of Jezreel. The entire force under Gideon's command numbered only 32,000 men. But with the vast host of the enemy spread out before him, the word of the Lord came, "The people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hands, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, Mine own hand hath saved me. Now therefore, proclaim in the ears of the people, saying, Whosoever is fearful and afraid, let him return and depart early from Mount Gilead." Those unwilling to face danger and hardship would add no strength to the armies of Israel. Gideon was filled with astonishment at the declaration that his army was too large. But the Lord saw the pride and unbelief in the hearts of his people. Aroused by the appeals of Gideon, they had readily enlisted, but many were filled with fear when they saw the multitudes of Midian. Yet, had Israel triumphed, those very ones would have taken glory to themselves instead of ascribing victory to God. Only 300 left. Gideon obeyed the Lord's direction, and with a heavy heart saw more than two-thirds of his force depart for their homes. Again the word of the Lord came to him, "The people are yet too many, bring them down unto the water, and I will try them for thee there, and it shall be, that of whom I say unto thee, This shall go with thee, the same shall go with thee, and of whomsoever I say unto thee, This shall not go with thee, the same shall not go." The people were led down to the waterside, expecting to make an immediate advance upon the enemy. A few hastily took a little water in the hand and sucked it up as they went on, but nearly all bowed upon their knees and leisurely drank from the surface of the stream. Those who took the water in their hands were but 300 out of 10,000. These were selected, all the rest were permitted to return to their homes. Those who in time of peril were intent upon supplying their own wants were not to be trusted in an emergency. The 300 chosen men not only possessed courage and self-control, they were men of faith. They had not defiled themselves with idolatry. God could direct them, and through them he could work deliverance for Israel. God is honored not so much by great numbers as by the character of those who serve him. The Israelites were stationed on the brow of a hill overlooking the valley where the invaders lay encamped like locusts for multitude, and their camels were without number, as the sand which is upon the seashore for multitude. Gideon trembled as he thought of the conflict of the morrow. But the Lord bade him go down to the camp of the Midianites. He would there hear something for his encouragement. Waiting in the darkness and silence, he heard a soldier relating a dream to his companion. "Lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it, that the tent lay along." The other answered in words that stirred the heart of that unseen listener, "This is nothing else save the sword of Gideon the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian, and all the host." Gideon recognized the voice of God speaking through those Midianitish strangers. Returning to the few men under his command, he said, "Arise, for the Lord hath delivered into your hand the host of Midian." God's simple battle plan. By divine direction, a plan of attack was suggested. The 300 men were divided into three companies. To every man was given a trumpet and a torch concealed in an earthen pitcher. The men were stationed in such a manner as to approach the Midianite camp from different directions. In the dead of night, at a signal from Gideon's war horn, the three companies sounded their trumpets. Then, breaking their pitchers and displaying the blazing torches, they rushed upon the enemy with the terrible war cry, "The sword of the Lord, and of Gideon." The sleeping army was suddenly aroused. Upon every side was seen the light of flaming torches. In every direction was heard the sound of trumpets with the cry of the assailants. Believing themselves at the mercy of an overwhelming force, the Midianites were panic-stricken. With wild cries of alarm they fled for life, and mistaking their own companions for enemies, they slew one another. As news of the victory spread, thousands of the men of Israel who had been dismissed to their homes returned and joined in pursuit of their fleeing enemies. Gideon sent messengers to the tribe of Ephraim, rousing them to intercept the fugitives at the southern fords. Meanwhile, with his 300, faint, yet pursuing, Gideon crossed the stream hard after those who had already gained the farther side. The two princes, Zeba and Zalmunna, who escaped with 15,000 men, were overtaken by Gideon, their force completely scattered, and the leaders captured and slain. 120,000 of the invaders perished. The power of the Midianites was broken. They were never again able to make war upon Israel. No words can describe the terror of the surrounding nations when they learned what simple means had prevailed against the power of a bold, warlike people. The leader whom God chose to overthrow the Midianites was not a ruler, a priest, or a Levite. He thought himself the least in his father's house. But he was distrustful of himself and willing to follow the guidance of the Lord. God selects those whom he can best use. Before honor is humility. He will make them strong by uniting their weakness to his might, and wise by connecting their ignorance with his wisdom. Few can be trusted with any large measure of responsibility or success without becoming forgetful of their dependence upon God. This is why, in choosing instruments for his work, the Lord passes by those whom the world honors as great, talented, and brilliant. They are proud and feel competent to act without counsel from God. Trust in God and obedience to his will are as essential in spiritual warfare as to Gideon and Joshua in their battles with the Canaanites. God is just as willing to work with the efforts of his people now, and to accomplish great things through weak instrumentalities. God is able to do exceeding abundantly above all that we ask or think. When at Gideon's call the men of Israel had rallied against the Midianites, the tribe of Ephraim had remained behind. As Gideon sent them no special summons, they availed themselves of this excuse not to join their brethren. But when news of Israel's triumph reached them, the Ephraimites were envious because they had not shared it. After the rout of the Midianites, they followed up the battle and helped complete the victory. Nevertheless, they were jealous and angry, as though Gideon had been led by his own will and judgment. They did not discern God's hand in the triumph of Israel, and this showed them unworthy to be chosen as his special instruments. Returning with the trophies of victory, they angrily reproached Gideon, "Why hast thou served us thus, that thou calledst us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites?" Gideon demonstrates humility. "What have I done now, in comparison of you?" said Gideon. "Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God hath delivered into your hand the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, and what was I able to do in comparison of you?" Gideon's modest answer soothed the anger of the men of Ephraim, and they returned in peace to their homes. Gideon displayed a spirit of courtesy rarely witnessed. The people of Israel, in their gratitude at deliverance from the Midianites, proposed to Gideon that he become their king, in direct violation of the principles of the theocracy. God was the king of Israel, and for them to place a man upon the throne would be a rejection of their divine sovereign. Gideon recognized this fact. His answer shows how true and noble were his motives. "I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." But Gideon was betrayed into another error, which brought disaster upon his house and upon all Israel. The season of inactivity that succeeds a great struggle is often fraught with greater danger than is the period of conflict. To this danger Gideon was now exposed. A spirit of unrest was upon him. Instead of waiting for divine guidance, he began to plan for himself. Because he had been commanded to offer sacrifice upon the rock where the angel appeared to him, Gideon concluded that he had been appointed as a priest. Without waiting for divine sanction, he determined to institute a system of worship similar to that carried on at the tabernacle. With the strong popular feeling in his favor, he found no difficulty in carrying out his plan. At his request, all the earrings of gold taken from the Midianites were given him as his share of the spoil. The people also collected other costly materials, together with the richly adorned garments of the princes of Midian. From the material thus furnished, Gideon constructed an ephod and a breastplate, in imitation of those worn by the high priest. His course proved a snare to himself and his family, as well as to Israel. The unauthorized worship led many of the people finally to forsake the Lord to serve idols. After Gideon's death, great numbers, among whom were his own family, joined in apostasy. The people were led away from God by the very man who once overthrew their idolatry. Those who stand in the highest positions may lead astray. The wisest err, the strongest may falter and stumble. Our only safety lies in trusting our way implicitly to Him who has said, "Follow me." After the death of Gideon, the people of Israel accepted his base-born son Abimelech as their king, who, to sustain his power, murdered all but one of Gideon's lawful children. The cruel course of Israel toward the house of Gideon was what might be expected from a people who manifested so great ingratitude to God. More backsliding and more misery. After the death of Abimelech, the rule of judges who feared the Lord served for a time to put a check on idolatry. But ere long the people returned to the practices of the heathen around them. Apostasy speedily brought punishment. The Ammonites subdued the eastern tribes and, crossing the Jordan, invaded the territory of Judah and Ephraim. On the west the Philistines came up from their plain beside the sea, burning and pillaging far and near. Israel seemed to be abandoned to the power of relentless foes. Again the people sought help from him whom they had forsaken and insulted. The children of Israel cried unto the Lord, saying, "We have sinned against thee, both because we have forsaken our God, and also served Balaam." But the people mourned because their sins had brought suffering upon themselves, not because they had dishonored God by transgression of His holy law. True repentance is a resolute turning away from evil. The Lord answered them through one of His prophets, "Did I not deliver you from the Egyptians, and from the Amorites, from the children of Ammon, and from the Philistines? Ye cried to me, and I delivered you out of their hand. Yet ye have forsaken me, and served other gods, wherefore I will deliver you no more. Go and cry unto the gods which ye have chosen, let them deliver you in the time of your tribulation." The Israelites now humbled themselves before the Lord. And they put away the strange gods from among them, and served Jehovah. And the Lord's heart of love was grieved for the misery of Israel. Oh, the long-suffering mercy of our God! When His people put away the sins that had shut out His presence, He heard their prayers and at once began to work for them. A deliverer was raised up in the person of Jephthah, who made war upon the Ammonites and effectually destroyed their power. For 18 years at this time Israel had suffered under the oppression of her foes, yet again the lesson taught by suffering was forgotten. As His people returned to their evil ways, the Lord permitted them to be oppressed by powerful enemies, the Philistines. For many years they were constantly harassed, and at times completely subjugated, by this cruel and warlike nation. They had mingled with these idolaters, uniting in pleasure and in worship until they seemed to be one with them in spirit and interest. Then these professed friends of Israel became their bitterest enemies and sought to accomplish their destruction. The Bible plainly teaches that there can be no harmony between the people of God and the world. Satan works through the ungodly, under cover of pretended friendship, to allure God's people into sin. When their defense is removed, then he will lead his agents to turn against them and seek to accomplish their destruction.